Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. All of our WNST coverage and the merging of 29 years of Baltimore sports on December the 13th into one place called Baltimore Positive, all brought to you by great, great sponsors, local people like our friends at Pizza John's and Planet Fitness and, of course, Royal Farms. But I want to tell you about Taharka because we got stuff going on here this month. It's a love season. It's a holiday season. It's a gift-giving season. And we're all shut in, and we need something good to eat. Taharka makes the best ice cream in the world, made here in Baltimore. Serving up social change. Big announcement coming down the line a little later on in the month. And not just that the eggnog's in and the peppermint bark's in and the sweet potato casserole's in, but we're going to be shipping this to you. $15.70 off. Just $40 for an 8-pack. Delivered to your door, and you have to be there to receive it. It's not like an Amazon package because it melts in your mouth, not on your porch. Taharka Brothers, will be telling you more about that next week and that great deal. State Fair, still doing it, socially distanced. The chicken and waffles, I got to get over there, curbside that. And our friends at El Guapo, Evan Brown joined us last week to talk about life during pandemic and opening up this delicious new Latin restaurant. I put a picture of the beef braised tacos with the onions up over the weekend. So check that out at BaltimorePositive.com as well. Make sure you're curbside. Make sure you take care of all of our local sponsors, all of your local businesses, anywhere you are. They need it more than ever this year for Thanksgiving and Black Friday and Cyber Monday and Cyber Tuesday, and order it online on Wednesday and get your crab cakes from Faithley's on Thursday. You can ship those anywhere in the world as well. We miss our times at State Fair and down at Faithley's at Lexington Market. Had some friends in this week for the Tennessee Titans game. Send them to Faithley's. They got the legitimate world-famous crab cakes. They probably want to ship them back to Tennessee like their football team when this is all over with. You can ship them to Tennessee or anywhere in the world. One click at WNST. And last but never least, Mueller & Gary Realty. Jeff Mueller is going to join me in a couple of weeks talking about selling homes in the 2021, trying to get my condo on the market. But I need an electrician. Don, this is why we built Baltimore Positive, a segment like this. I mean, I was going to get all dressed up and get my hair done did and break out my John Waters, and I saw that you are trying to fish to get John Waters on the program here. You better use your mute button that day because I'm not sharing John Waters with you. You book John Waters on the show, suddenly the cable's not going to work in 2028. But John Waters is involved in this segment. Baltimore is involved in this segment. Jersey's involved in this segment, which there's some Springsteen and some Smithereens in there. But you book this one. And, you know, every once in a while I surprise you with a Cal Ripken or, you know, sneak up on you with a Ken Singleton or something. But then you sneak up on me with something. So this is one of yours. So go ahead.
Well, when I see a book that has the title, Come and Be Shocked, Baltimore Beyond John Waters and The Wire, I say to myself, Nestor is going to
hold that book up. Let me see that.
In
book.
Love. Come and Be Shocked, Baltimore Beyond John Waters and The Wire. We welcome Rutgers professor, the author of this book, has to be on everybody's Christmas shopping list. Get out there, buy it wherever you buy your books now. We welcome Rutgers professor, Mary Rizzo. Mary, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to chat with you guys. And thank you for holding the book up. They did a great job. The Johns Hopkins Press did a great job on the cover. So
most importantly, what exit? Let's get that out of the way right away.
Hey, so I grew up in Central Jersey, which if you're a Jersey person, you know that even saying Central Jersey exists is a complicated
Trenton,
position.
Isn't it?
I'm on the other side. I grew up near the shore, actually, the northern part of the shore. So,
well, not too far away from where Bruce Springsteen once stood next to me at the bookstore. Was
there you go.
Right in the hometown there, you know,
exactly.
Somewhere in the swamp.
Mary, I may have booked this segment, but I full well know that I'm going to have trouble getting a word in edgewise. So I'm going to start because I know it might be the last question that I get to ask. I have to wonder, how does a Jersey girl, a Rutgers professor, get interested in telling the quirky, and I love that. I mean, because nothing describes this book better than quirky, the quirky story of Baltimore. How does this come about?
So, and I'll try not to do the long version of the story, because there is a long version, but back in
Well, give us the long version.
Awesome. Okay, great.
We do long form interviews.
It's coffee talk is what we're doing here.
I love it. I've got
Brought
some
to you
tea,
by Royal Farms, of course.
Yeah, so in about 1999, I was in grad school, and I was actually at the University of Minnesota, so I was out in Minneapolis, and I was working on my dissertation, which I was looking at class identity and how people perform their class identity, and I heard about HunFest, which, you know, I'm sure many of the folks who are listening know what HunFest is, but in case you don't, it's this annual festival that takes place in Hampton in Baltimore, where women dress up as the Baltimore Hun, this kind of icon who looks like a sort of a 1960s diner waitress, big beehive hairdo, cat's eye glasses, the whole thing.
Don, I love how the Jersey chicks explain it to the Dundalk guy about HunFest.
Hey, listen.
It's great. I love it. It's awesome.
Just in case, right?
So my mother was a Hun. My mother might have been the most famous Hun of this century in Baltimore.
She was as Hun gets, Nestor.
Yeah. That's pretty funny, though.
I love it. So, yeah, so I heard about HunFest, and I thought, well, this sounds really interesting, so let me go take a look at this, because it really fits into the stuff that I'm interested in. So I went out to HunFest, and at that point, it was a very small festival. It was still like right next to the Cafe Hun. It hadn't expanded the way it did. And so I started chatting with people there, doing interviews, et cetera, and really got interested in the relationship between HunFest and the neighborhood of Hampton. So I wrote a little bit about that and, you know, published a couple of articles.
What is that the study of? What class was this?
So this is actually for my dissertation, but it's in American Studies, which is a great field, interdisciplinary. You can kind of study all sorts of different things related to the, you know, America and the concept of America. So this is a sort of cultural exploration.
I just want to cue like a Mellencamp song right now, you know?
I like it.
So this was it was a college thought, right? Literally, right?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then, as I said, I published a couple of articles about it. And then truly, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, in the preface, I got to know some of the ladies who dress up for HunFest on a regular basis, including Charlene Osborne, who was Baltimore's best Hun several years ago. And she was being, there was a potential pilot for a sort of real Housewives type reality show, but about Baltimore Huns that was being filmed, and she was part of it. So she invited me to come down to her house in Dundalk. And
every time you say bee, I think beehive. I just want to say beehive.
Yeah. And so I go down to Dundalk, and I'm sitting in her garage with all these women dressed up in the Hun outfits, having this guy film me for a potential reality TV show. And I just thought, like, there is something here about Baltimore that it has such a meaning and a recognition that someone could think that you could make a reality TV show about it, right? And the TV show
never
ended up
happening.
Well,
John Waters has made 50 years of it, right? Literally.
Exactly. And that's what made me think about. I was like, so what else is there? So there's John Waters, there's David Simon, there's Barry Levinson, there's Ann Tyler. I mean, there are so many different really important figures who have made Baltimore famous through the work that they do as artists. And so I became really interested in that question of, like, what's the relationship between the art that they're producing and the image of the city that people know about? And then how does the city itself, the sort of municipal government, get involved in this, right? Because through tourism, through arts funding, they're also pushing their own version of the city as well.
See, if I would have been elected mayor, we've been all over this. Mary Rizzo is here. She's written a book. So you go from Minnesota to New Jersey, yet you remain interested in Baltimore, right? So this... I mean, you're speaking my language, because, like, my wife and I walk the city. We live at the Inner Harbor. Mm-hmm. I came down here when I was a little boy in the McCormick factories, like literally next door to where I was, and smelling the cinnamon. I was here the day that Harbor Place came. So, like, I'm sort of old school with all of this. And yeah. I mean, I'm Baltimore positive. You know what I mean? I've sort of turned it into a thing. But I've traveled the world now, and when I walk through here, I see the elements of Asia coming to life in regard to water and the port and Hong Kong and places that I've been like that. I also see the old Amsterdam, Dublin, Northern European feel for what the landscape looks like and the waterways and all of that. But I also see that 100 years ago, people came here. My wife is of Polish descent. Everybody on the east side of town, that my church, all of that, were all, I was not Polish. I was sort of a mutt from Venezuela. But the pockets of Little Italy and Barry Levinson's Avalon. Have you ever seen Avalon, by the way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Did you cry at Avalon? I cried. I admitted to Barry Levinson last year that he had me at coming out of the Senator Theater bawling my eyes out, walking into a Royal Farms 30 years ago. But Baltimore has been romanticized, right, for half a century, whether it's Tin Man, whether any of those movies that would have portrayed it that way. Obviously, the sports side of our heroes of Brooks Robinson and Johnny Unitas, we think of ourselves as a sports town here. But in modern times, the last 20 years, the portrayal of The Wire, of Homicide, of, and I've spoken of this 1,000 times, that this is how Baltimore Positive was born, Mary. I wore an Oriole hat or a Raven hat. I would get off a plane 20 years ago, and people want to talk about our crab cakes or Fort McHenry or the great time they had in Fells Point or Ray Lewis or whatever it would be. Now, when I say I'm from Baltimore, I lead with that. It's a completely different narrative that only the people here can change.
Well, you know, Nestor, I want to jump in there, and then I want to turn to Mary with what I think is a key question from this book. But what you just said, Nestor, literally just happened to me the past week or two. I was with a local reporter who's a good friend, and we were talking about her career. And she was talking about the moment as a young reporter when she had several offers as to which city to go to and was leaning toward coming to Baltimore. And her mom and dad said, honey, the Wire, that was their image of Baltimore. Honey, are you sure? Have you seen The Wire? So that image maintains. And that really is, I think, Mary, the question that I'd like you to talk a little bit about, because you pose it in the book and you say, how do the images created by imaginary cities by artists affect the real cities? And boy, Nestor laid it out. Talk to us a little bit about that premise, that these imaginary images affect real cities.
Absolutely. Right. So, and, you know, we could think about this beyond Baltimore, right? I'm sure like any of us could think about any city that we've never been to before and probably have an image in our head of that city. Well, where does that image come from? You know, it comes from a variety of different places, but certainly cultural representation is one of them, right? And, you know, so for Baltimore, one of the things I talk about in the book is that there's been over the course of, let's say, since the 1950s, but really specifically since the 1970s, the development of these sort of two images of the city of Baltimore, right? So you have Charm City on one hand, and then you have what I refer to as Bodymore on the other hand. And so, you know, Charm City is the sort of John Waters version of Baltimore. It's eccentric, it's quirky, it's fun, and it's white for the most part, right? I mean, we're talking about seeing white people primarily representing Charm City, and Charm City represents sort of cultures, white cultures, right? So these are the cultural heritages of mainly white folks. Bodymore, on the other hand, is the image that we see in The Wire or Homicide, and lots of other depictions as well, of course, right? Urban street fiction, right? It's the side of Baltimore that is mainly associated with African-American people, and it's mainly associated with danger and death, right? So that these are the spaces that when your friend is being told, like, oh, are you sure you want to move to Baltimore? You know, those are the spaces that that the person is referring to, as these are kind of the scary spaces. And the point that I make in the book is that these two narratives are happening parallel to each other, you know, so that they are being developed at the same time and they rely on each other. So that Bodymore is makes sense because it's contrasted with Charm City and vice versa. So that it's really important to understand the dynamic of who is constructing those images and why certain ones are getting pushed in particular ways rather than others.
Well, the same thing can be said from where you are, right? I mean, when I drive, you know, about 3 exits north of you, you know, woke up this morning, got myself, you know, like all of a sudden, you know, I see the bridges and I'm like, and I'm looking for, you know, I'm looking for the bada bing, right? So
yeah,
that comes from spending 8 years of my life watching The Sopranos and actually being from this part of the world where I've driven through the Meadowlands and past the bada bing and Secaucus and all of that. And you know, you associate that with that. And I never knew the power of The Wire. I haven't watched The Wire, right, Mary? Mm. So, and I admit that. I admit that to David, you know, like, I don't want to be trapped in that here. You know what I mean? It's because I think it might affect me in some weird way, even though it's fictional, or is it?
But it, one of our regular guests here on Baltimore Positive is legendarily not a fan of The Wire, and that's former mayor and governor Martin O'Malley. He did not like the portrayal of Tommy Carsetti and the way the city was portrayed. But as we point out, those things become real. You know, Mary, you really aged me, and Nestor loves things that age me in the book. Because of my age, as a young kid, my mom was single mom. She worked. So when my brother and I would get home from school, we needed babysitters to be there with us until she got home from work. And there were two young guys in the neighborhood. Not only did they like to throw the ball around and play catch, so they were perfect, but here was the routine. We would get home, and these guys would turn on the Buddy Dean Show. And you do a whole segment in this book on the Buddy Dean Show. And for those of you who are way too young to have heard Buddy Dean, think Dick Clark, Google Dick Clark and Buddy Dean, and think of the Philadelphia version and the Baltimore version. And certainly Waters captured this with Hairspray, both on Broadway and in the movie. But boy, you do a terrific job of talking about it reflecting the racial strife at the time, including, again, going to age myself, the dance, the Madison. Because I can hear the voice, I can see the stroll, I can do the big Wilt Chamberlain. I know.
Oh, whoa. Plague is over, we're going to go to the 2-1, and you and Linda are going to – Madison, is that what's going on?
I can actually do the Madison, and Mary's going to tell you about the racial overtones of the Madison.
Yeah, no, thank you for mentioning that. So, yeah, so, I mean, and for people who aren't aware, right, so, you know, John Waters' movie Hairspray is a sort of retelling of the Buddy Dean Show, but he changes the ending. So, like, you know, spoiler, at the end of Hairspray, which is about the integration of this teen dance TV show in John Waters' movie, right, they integrate the show. But in the real life story in Baltimore, the Buddy Dean Show refused to integrate, so that there were civil rights activists in the city, white and black teenagers who were trying to get the show to integrate. And at that time, what it would have is, it was on every day. It was the most popular TV show in Baltimore at that time. And so
it was MTV for people like Don.
Right. I mean, you think about it, you would like be
every
a kid,
day.
Right. You'd get home, my understanding, right? You get home, you turn on the TV, and you'd watch other teens dancing to like the hottest songs, right? So they would become these celebrities. And every day, except for one day a month, it was all white. And then the one day a month, they would only have black teenagers on the show. So these activists were trying to integrate the show. And there was a lot of pressure on the studio to do that. But Buddy Dean, and it's a little unclear exactly, you know, who refused, but, you know, Buddy Dean as the host of the show, the white teenagers who kind of ran the show as the committee, did not want to integrate the show. And instead of integrating it, they canceled, the TV station canceled the show. So it really reflects how rigid the sort of racial boundaries in Baltimore were at the time, you know, because rather than keep this very successful TV show, local TV show going, they were like, nope, we would rather just cancel it instead.
Well, and Mary, my recollection also, and you can talk, I think you allude to this as well. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure you do in the book, that it was interesting because it was okay one day a month to have African American Day. And one day a month, they would have on Buddy Dean, they would have a guest disc jockey like Paul Fat Daddy Johnson from WSID or someone else.
Was my man Rockin' Robin one of them? Freddie Robinson?
I don't remember, but I do remember Fat Daddy. And my recollection is that it was okay to have one day a month where African Americans got to come on and dance, and that was supposed to make it all okay.
Right.
My recollection growing up as well, Mary, is similar to yours, is that I think Buddy Dean was actually from Arkansas.
That's right.
So this whole concept of integration was really a challenge for him. And you talk about, for folks that don't know, Nestor, again, way predating your time, and Mary captures it beautifully in the book. And again, for those of you out there, the book, come and be shocked. Baltimore Beyond, John Waters and The Wire, Mary Rizzo, available wherever you get your books. Great gift for whatever you're celebrating at the holidays.
By the way, Mary, as a fellow author, I appreciate guys like Mole that still read books.
Put it on your reading list. But Mary mentions, Nestor, you'll find this fascinating, and I won't out them here, but I know at least one fairly prominent elected official who was, quote unquote, a committee member. And Mary, can tell folks why, what, I mean, because the committee member, I'll tell you, as a seventh grade boy, every seventh grade boy in Baltimore loved Mary Lou Rhines. So I can still, not only do I remember the committee, I remember Mary Lou Rhines. So tell folks about the committee and the role they played in telling Baltimore's story.
Yeah. So the committee was super fascinating. So you had this teen dance show and what, so you'd have these kids who were regular dancers on the show. And then what show did was sort of elevate a group of them to be the committee. And they kind of ran the show, frankly. And what they would do is they would monitor the other teens because the show had all of these rules. And again, this is, you know, we're talking about like the late 50s, early 60s. So there were a lot of rules. Like, so you couldn't dance too close to someone else and you couldn't dance certain dances and, you know, everything was, you couldn't chew gum. Like, it'd be very particular. And so,
well, this was Elvis. I mean, hips were like, you know, right? Literally.
It was dangerous, right? This was like about sex. It was scary. It was dangerous. And so the committee members, these other teens, would monitor the other dancers. So they gave them all this power. And like, it's weird to give teens that much power because, you know, sometimes they kind of go a little crazy with it. And so they would be the ones who would actually be enforcing all of the rules. So they were quite powerful. And they were very powerful too, as like teens within the city. So when you mentioned the Madison, you know, there was a national tour to teach the Madison as a dance to teens all over the country. And two of the committee members from the Buddy Dean Show went on this national tour to teach the Madison. So it really did have this of ability to make a teen a celebrity, which gave them a lot of power. You know, and they were very powerful in then making that decision to not integrate the show either, right? Because whether it's because they were uncomfortable, their parents were uncomfortable, some combination of it, but you know, they were part of the voice that said, no, we would rather not integrate.
Well, then you've got this fascinating story that you're telling about Buddy Dean, the committee, and these kids were famous. I mean, you went whatever shop they told you to go buy the special shirt. I mean, I can remember my mom taking me over to Lee's.
Is that how the merry-go-round called home a boogie?
Lee's of Broadway, Nestor, was one of the sponsors of the Buddy Dean Show. And from Catonsville to go all the way over to Lee's of Broadway was a trek. But that's what the guys on the committee wore, so we needed to have that shirt. But at the same time,
marketing 101, just like the Taharka ice cream you need to have for the holidays right here.
So while you're telling that story, again, this is why you do have, Nestor, why you do have to read books. So I'm reading your book, and then you say, but at the time of Buddy Dean, there's this counter narrative in a book called The City of Anger by William Manchester. And I'm thinking, William Manchester? Now, wait a minute. That can't be the same William Manchester that wrote the famous book Death of a President that almost everybody back in the 60s and 70s read William Manchester's. And I look it up, and sure enough, it's the same William Manchester. So he writes this book called The City of Anger. And talk about the counter narrative that he's presenting that really is the direct opposite of Buddy Dean.
Yeah, no, it's super fascinating. And I had the same reaction when I heard about The City of Anger. I was like, wait, William Manchester, right? Can't be the same guy. But he had been a journalist at the Baltimore Sun. And, you know, there's so many journalists at the Baltimore Sun go on to be these great authors. And so he writes this book, this fiction, this novel, but it's based on the reporting that he'd been doing. So I got to go through his papers, which are at Wesleyan University. It was super fascinating because he had all these clippings of newspaper articles that he had written, but also all these handwritten notes about people he had interviewed who never got into the newspaper articles. And he was really interested in the kind of marginalized people in Baltimore. He was really concerned. So, you know, Baltimore has a very strong history of residential segregation and a history of housing injustice. So that, you know, working class African-American folks, as well as white folks too, but certainly African-American folks found it really difficult to find decent housing. And he became really fascinated by this story. And so part of what the City of Anger is about is actually blockbusting, which, again, for folks who may remember this or lived through it, this was a process by which real estate agents would go into white neighborhoods and suggest that Black people were going to move into this white neighborhood and kind of panic that neighborhood into selling their houses at low prices. And real estate agents would then sell those houses to Black people at much higher prices. And so it was this process by which, you know, these neighborhoods shifted from white to Black, created a ton of conflict between African-American and white people. And the people who benefited were really only the real estate speculators. And so this becomes a major plot point in The City of Anger, where he's talking about how all of these white and Black working class people are pitted against each other in this way where neither of them are actually benefiting from this system. And it also includes the whole numbers racket, which was a huge thing in Baltimore at the time, was the illegal lottery that then becomes the legal lottery like years later. But he has
it's now a salad.
Lottery.
It's the bookmaker salad. It is, famously. Well, you can't get a bookmaker salad in Minneapolis on your dissertation there. I'll tell you that.
Right.
Mary, one of the things, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is an assumption of mine, having read your book now. While you clearly had an affinity for a lot of the characters and a lot of the experiences that you wrote about, I got a sense that what really touched your heart was the discovery of a little poetry magazine called Chicory. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes.
Chicory?
Yep, absolutely.
And it looked to me like when you came across that, that was a golden nugget where you said, wow, this is a moment. If I'm right, tell our folks a little bit about Chicory and why it tickled your fancy.
Yeah, absolutely. You're 100% right. And you know, I totally remember, I mean, this is how the historians work, right? I was looking through a book that was written in like 1980 or something, and it had a mention of this poetry magazine called Chicory that, you know, it suggested it was published by the Enoch Pratt Free Library, and it was mainly African-American poetry magazine. And I thought, well, the next time I'm in Baltimore doing research, I'll stop by the library and take a look at it. And I go to the library, they wheel in a cart of these boxes of bound copies of this magazine, which was published between 1966 and 1983. So it was like a stack.
Shout out to Heidi Daniel. There you go, right there.
Yeah, exactly. And so I start flipping through the first issue, and this would have been 2014, right? So I start flipping through the first issue, it's November 1966 issue, and I read a poem by a young Black man named Turk, whose nickname is Turk, and he talks about being harassed by the police in Baltimore as he's walking his girlfriend home one night and how he feared for his life. And I was like, wow, this is exactly what is happening now. This was 2014, so it's before Freddie Gray, but of course still in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement. And as I went through this magazine, and it was just issue after issue of people talking about their lives, I realized, like, as a historian, this is the kind of resource that you very rarely find, right? Where you and what's important is that it was not really edited, right? So people really wrote in their own voice, and it's poetry, it's artwork, it's you know, short stories, it's essays, you know, it's all
from
of these
what
things.
Time frame again?
So from November 1966 until 1983. So
okay.
It's a long period of time, and they.
So I'm thinking about that period of time. I mean, in my life in the 70s, like the city paper was kind of coming on, you know, FM radio, places where you would have a voice of any mm-hmm. kind. I mean, you know, I'm of the age where the only way to get published was to send a letter into to the paper, right, or in a community newspaper. So, just getting published meant something in the 80s. I would think in the 60s and 70s that there weren't avenues like this much at all, other than
exactly.
Maybe for at Morgan State or the early part of Coppin for students writing, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. And when I talk about this with my students, I always say, like, you know, you have to remember this before the internet, right? People didn't have a platform where they could just say whatever they wanted and reach hundreds of people, never mind thousands or whatever. And so this magazine was that platform. And what's really fascinating about it is, you know, it was very much within this kind of Black working class community. And so it starts in East Baltimore, but then it's kind of spreads throughout the city. And it actually so it starts in 66, but in 69, the YMCA Press publishes a book of poems from Chicory. So then it has this national reach. And, you know, it had a mailing list where people across the country were getting copies of these issues. So it's an incredible resource. as a historian, right? But then for the people who were writing for it, it was this way for them to speak about their lives. And what was great is, you know, Pratt Library is amazing. I love the folks there. So when I kind of, they knew they had this, but, you know, they had forgotten about it, right? So when I brought to their attention how historically important this was, we worked together and we were able to digitize it. So now you can actually go online and read all of the issues of Chicory if you want, right? So you can see it for yourself now. And I'm working with a group of folks in Baltimore to try to do more with Chicory, right? So we have an Instagram account where we highlight poems from Chicory and connect them with what's going on today. That's at Chicory_Baltimore if anyone wants to follow us on Instagram. So yeah, so Chicory to me is probably one of the best finds of this research. And the other part that I just want to mention about that is, you know, when I started doing this book, I thought, you know, the easy stuff was to write about, you know, John Waters and David Simon and Ann Tyler and Barry Levinson, right? Those are the famous names, right? But that's only one piece of the story, right? Because there are all these folks who are also artists, who are also telling stories of Baltimore, who don't get famous. And, you know, a lot of times that's because of their class and their race. And so I wanted to make sure that I got that perspective as well. And Chicory is really important to doing that.
Mary, what's, I love the way you just said that. There are all these, and we'll get back to Simon in a moment, but I love the fact you said there are all these other voices. If it's a really hard question, so I'll say that up front. Put you on the spot. What's the overarching image of Baltimore, your takeaway from the pieces that were shared in Chicory that are available? And I agree with Nestor. A shout out to our friend Heidi Daniel at the Enoch Pratt. Support the Pratt. Go on and check out Chicory. But what
got free right in it?
If I were to do a painting, or if I were to do an hour documentary, if I was, you know, going to bring in Ken Burns and say, paint me Baltimore based upon what you read in Chicory, what would Burns' film look like?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And here's what I think. You know, I think it would be I think it would be two things simultaneously. I think it would be a really clear-eyed look at the struggles that were happening, and, you know, and still are happening in a working class and poor neighborhoods in Baltimore. So the people who write in there are writing about a drug addiction. They're writing about crime. They're writing about poverty, right? Talking about, you know, how does our community deal with this? And at the same time, and this is one of the things that I find really powerful about it, is they are also writing about joy. They're writing about, like, finding joy in community, in music, in art, in poetry, in dance, and, you know, that sort of and the beauty of the imagination, right? Because these are artists, and so they also have this great imagination. So they're not just writing about, like, this is the terrible thing that I see outside of my window every day. They're also creating these whole imaginary worlds. So I think that those are the two things that strike me, is it's, like, very deeply realistic, and on the other hand, it is so deeply joyful. That's what I would say is someone would walk away as, like, the big picture of it.
What a wonderful term.
Is our guest here. I my parting shot for you is, how much time have you actually spent here? How many nights with your head on a pillow in Baltimore in your life?
Oh God, I don't know how to quantify
hundreds
that.
Hundreds or
not hundreds probably, but I've been doing research for this book for a long time and before that. So yeah, maybe 100.
Okay, fair enough. So what is your favorite part of Baltimore? What's your favorite, when you come to Baltimore, what's the thing you do? What do you love about it?
I love to just walk around the city, right? So I'm a walker, right? So I like to just be able to, like, go, and Baltimore, one of the nice things is it's, like, a fairly small city. So if you're willing to walk far, you can go, you know, all the way from, or, like, I usually come in from the train. I live in Newark. So I come in from the train and I'll walk from the Penn Station down to, like, the Inner Harbor. And what I love about that is then you really see all the sort of different neighborhoods, right? And it's very cliche to say that Baltimore is a city of neighborhoods. And there is also truth to that. And I think you see it when you walk through it, right? And you get that sense of, like, these are sort of distinct places with their own histories and their own kind of culture today.
Well, you know, well, Mary, the wildest thing is I live at the Inner Harbor, okay? Mm-hmm. And the train station for me and my wife, it's our neighborhood, right? We've lived here 17 years downtown. My wife's not from here. So I proposed to my wife on Federal Hill in 2003. She's from Manchester, New Hampshire. She had spent, I don't know, like 4 days here for some phone conference she was here for before she met me. Other than that, she'd never really been to Baltimore. She's a couple days. she still, to this day, we've been all over the world. I mean, Paris, Asia, you know, not Africa, but all over Europe. And when we drive from the train station down St. Paul or up Charles, and I live literally between St. Paul and Charles, when we drive, the architecture where the Washington Monument is and where just Mount Vernon in general, you know, there are very few places in the world where the architecture looks like Baltimore. Mm-hmm. In this country, maybe just Boston, right?
Well, I was thinking, Nestor, as Mary was talking, I was thinking, I would put money, if I were a betting man, which you know I am not, I would put money that you all have walked past one another on numerous occasions. Because when Mary's talking about where she was, you and your wife walk all of the time. And I'm thinking, you and Jen and Mary have walked past one another.
Well, the old bookshop now up there, the red bookshop is now like a taco joint. So we want to get up. But like COVID has kind of wrecked a lot of this for us for the time being. But it's also brought it to life, right? Like, so I'm 52 years old. I grew up in East Baltimore. I admitted to everyone back in May, COVID put a mask on. My wife and I wound up in Patterson Park. I didn't know it had a pond and birds. I've lived here my whole life. So the COVID has done things like make you walk around and see things. Like if you were here and you walked that walk, have you ever been in the Peabody room, in the book room at the Peabody? Have you been there?
I actually haven't.
Yeah. Okay. So I've only been there once in my life. It's the most beautiful room I've ever been in, like anywhere. And it's in Baltimore. And I've only experienced it once because I got invited there for a thing. But there are nooks and crannies here that, like, I've been here my whole life and I got to call Jock Kelly to figure out how to go find them. That's why when someone from the outside comes in, I am always an outside explorer. Everywhere around the world I go, I walk places and see things or try to. I always try to see this place through the eyes of someone who comes from the outside and falls in love with it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Mary, I was thinking as I read your book, we recently, and you may have crossed paths, we interviewed another good friend of the show, Ron Cassie, who's senior editor at Baltimore Magazine. He's written a book that's just come out, collection of his essays, If You Love Baltimore, It Will Love You Back. And it has so much of the quirkiness that your book captures as well, screen painting to the history of Irish.
And he's an outsider as well. He's not from here.
It goes on and on and on. So there really are bookends. But before we let you get out of here, I want, because I think there's such important historical figures in Baltimore. You talk about three really important African-American families in the history of Baltimore. You talk about the Murphy family, the Jackson family, and the Mitchell family. And any of us who have lived here a long time know all of those names. Sort of give folks a sense of those families and why they're important to the history of Baltimore.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, Baltimore has an incredible history of civil rights activism that predates what we think of as the civil rights era, and obviously extends far beyond that too, right? So, you know, for example, if you think about the Murphy family who started the Afro-American newspaper, which became this national chain, you know, starts in Baltimore, becomes this national chain of African-American newspapers that is absolutely essential to the civil rights movement. Again, way before the 1950s, you know, because white-owned newspapers were not necessarily going to be telling the stories about what was happening in the African-American community. And if they did, they weren't necessarily going to be telling it from the perspective of the African-American community. So something like something seemingly as simple as an African-American newspaper is huge, because that's how you mobilize people. That's how you tell people across the country that, you know, the issues being faced by African-Americans are locally specific, but also have this kind of national connection to them. And so you don't have a civil rights movement without that. And then, you know, you have the Jackson family of the Mitchells, right? These are political families who are working within the city as both politicians, but also on the kind of organizational level at the NAACP to try to force Baltimore to, you know, live up to its African-American citizens' needs and interests, right? So without those three families, you know, you don't have the kind of history of civil rights activism in Baltimore. And I don't know what Baltimore would look like without them, frankly. So hugely important folks. And, you know, you see their names all over buildings and things like that. And that's correct, because they were critical in shaping Baltimore today.
I was going to smile because, you know, I get my orange juice from Kiefer Mitchell. So I was going to say, man, I get orange juice on Sunday morning from one of them. So yeah.
Hey, Nestor, before we let Mary run, because you're a music guy, Mary talks about every city has a playlist. So Baltimore has a playlist, Mary. What's on that playlist?
Oh, boy. So it's not like necessarily the happiest song that you want to play at the beginning of your day, but I do love the song Baltimore, which is originally by Randy Newman, but then covered by Nina Simone. And to me, and the fact that you have like a white guy, Randy Newman, writing it and singing it, and then you have Nina Simone covering it, to me, it absolutely suggests the kind of theme of the book that I was talking about before, the sort of racial bifurcation of the city. That song, I think, is just absolutely beautiful and has to be on that Baltimore playlist.
See, for all of our musicians here, like whether it's Rick Ocasek or David Byrne on the rock and roll side, or even my buddies from Charm City Devils doing the Hairspray thing and Hammer Jacks, which I have a link to, I guess, in the modern era. But just the amount of entertainers that have come through here, whether it's the Elvises and the Zeppelins and the Beatles, that are like of lore, that inspire, you know, young people. The Buddy Dean thing. Don, I hadn't thought of Buddy Dean in a long time, so I'm really glad you brought this one.
I told you, I'm an old guy whose babysitter was addicted. But Buddy Fritz and Bobby Foyles, those were the babysitters, and Buddy Fritz and Bobby Foyles would turn on the Buddy Dean show, and that's why I can do the Madison and the big Wilt Chamberlain
be honest with you now. I'm 52. Don's a little bit of a generation older than I, but I was always amazed, and I grew up in Dundalk, so like on the, you know, east line of a lot of Highland Town people. We had a lot of Huns. I mean, I am from a village and a family of Huns. And the men of that era, of your era, and maybe even a little older than you, Don, could all dance. Mm-hmm. Like when we go to the Bull Roast and the Oyster Fest and stuff like that on the east side, the Eastern Center, men of that age could dance. And it never really occurred to me that it was because y'all sat around in the afternoons and that's what you did it for. Like, this is a revelation, man. I feel like I'm having therapy here today,
Mary. Full disclosure. I didn't say I danced well.
You tried, you know?
Hey, Mary, this has been absolutely terrific. Again, folks, it's gift time. Come and be shocked. Baltimore, Beyond John Waters and The Wire. Get this. Get Ron Cassie's book. If you love Baltimore, love you back. It's time to read. What else are you going to do? We're locked in for another couple of months.
Mary, when you're ready for part two, come see me. I'll show you my Baltimore, okay?
I'd love it. When COVID is over, I will definitely take you up on that offer.
When this all breaks down, I'll just be the guy on the corner doing Baltimore tours, you know?
Awesome.
Because before COVID, I was the guy that stood at the harbor like, you need your picture taken? Here, give me your camera. You know, like, that's the guy I am. You need a recommendation? Amici's is over there. Just go over there and get the garlic bread. Get the meatballs. Thank you for your time and your book. And we're always in search of people on the outside who could come in here and try to make sense of this quirky little village of ours. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much. This was so much fun to chat with you both. Thank you.
Mary Rizzo, somewhere in the swamps of Jersey. So we'll honk the horn on our way next time we're going up to New York, up there at Rutgers University. It's our time. You can find Don and I at Baltimore Positive. We got the app going now, Stitcher, Apple, Google, iTunes, all that stuff. So you can just listen. If you really want to see how good looking Don is, you can follow us out on our YouTube WNSTV channel. And, of course, all of it now at BaltimorePositive.com. We brought our brand to life. WNST.net, AM 1570, still doing sports, still doing Ravens, still getting you ready for pumpkin pie, pecan pie, sweet potato pie, and a scoop of vanilla bean ice cream from our friends at Taharka. We've got a heck of a Taharka deal coming your way. We'll be telling you about that as we get up on Black Friday. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.